was a feeling in the air. Everything was quiet, things were different everywhere. The Wobblies were back again with Joe Hill at the mic. When all the minimum wage workers went on strike, there was no one flipping burgers. All the grills were cold, onion rings were in their bags, fries were growing bold. There were no baristas at Starbucks asking how many shots would you like, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. There was no one pumping gasoline, no one driving from town to town, no one at the registers, all the highways were shut down. We're stuck in the garage, CEOs on bikes, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. Fruit was falling off the trees, no one to load the trucks. Corn was rotting on the stalks, no farmhands to shuck. Workfare workers were hanging at home, spending the day with their tights, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. Yuppie parents were at home, their nannies left the job. Walmart workers said enough of our labor has been robbed. The Foot Locker was locked up, the boss had to take a hike, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. When I awoke one morning, there was a feeling in the air. Everything was quiet, things were different everywhere. The Wobblies were back again with T-Bone at the mic, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. When all the minimum wage workers went on strike.
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just tuning into this program, we're listening to The U.S. Economy with Joseph Stiglitz and Paul Krugman. The great Joseph Stiglitz, author of The Price of Inequality, and the equally great Paul Krugman, author of End This Depression Now, talk about the problems facing the U.S. economy.
There was a study done in Oslo a couple of years ago. A number of people participating in a study, Germany, the UK, the United States, and Sweden. And they asked a battery of questions. And not surprisingly, the United States respondents distrusted government more than any of the other countries. And the one question that stood out is, do I trust our government to protect me from powerful interests? And the American answer, no, was off the scales. It was 10 or 15 points more distrust.
You know, part of the reason for that may be related to the subject of inequality that we've been talking about, that and Paul has written about this as well, that we have such a high level of inequality, economic inequality, that inevitably it gets translated into political inequality, and particularly given the rules of the game, just like the rules of the economic game determine how the economic system plays out and lead to this high level of inequality, we now have political rules of the game, like Citizens United, that give scope for money, so we've moved closer to a system rather than one person, one vote, to $1, one vote. And then that becomes a self-reinforcing, so you have more political inequality that generates laws and regulations that lead to more economic inequality, and that reverberates back into more political inequality. An example that I just find astounding are something like our bankruptcy law. You know, it's something very technical, nobody normally gets interested in. One provision of the bankruptcy law is that when you go bankrupt, the question is who gets paid first? That's the big issue. And the answer is the derivatives. Not a surprise, because they put it in when everybody else was not noticing what, you know, who pays attention to bankruptcy laws. But what does that mean? That means you encourage that kind of economic activity. But at the other extreme, student loans can't be discharged even in bankruptcy. So that means that the banks do well, but it really discourages people borrowing for student loans. And in a country where we have tuition going up in the last 3 years, I think it's average state university tuition has gone up about 40% because of the cutbacks in
state budgets.
Yeah. Incomes are going down. The only way that people can afford it is borrowing. And then they realize that if they get cheated, as a lot of them have been, particularly in the for-profit private schools, the result of that is that if you don't get a job, given the recession, it's a noose around your neck.
You're both teachers. What do you tell young people right now? They're looking at those tuition bills and those loan rates.
Oh.
And the unemployment level for youth.
You know, the problem, I don't know, Joe must have something like this. The problem is that Princeton is such a rarefied, right? It's very... It's the 1% or less.
One tenth of 1%.
And to the extent that students are not coming from the 1%, they got a pretty generous scholarships because the school has a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's a fair.
It's not frightening.
But no, I mean, but I certainly have young people I know, relatives, for really urging them to find ways to not be dependent. And we've got a nephew. Thank God, teaching English in Japan, so he's got a job, and urging him to stay there until the job market is better here. This sort of comes back. We sort of moved off the questions of the current depressed economy. But among other things, when people say, "Well, can we really afford to spend to boost the economy?" The costs of not doing that are a lost among other things, a lost generation of young people.
Yep.
It's a terrible job market. People are young people are coming out of school, out of college, or even if they choose not to go to college, coming out of high school, into a market that has no use for them. They never get that first job that makes use of their potential. They never get started on the ladder. And this is we're going to be paying a price for our inaction in the face of mass unemployment. We're going to be paying that price 30 years from now still because of what we're doing to the human potential of this nation.
Yeah, Paul is absolutely right. And it's particularly foolish. Right now, the U.S. government can borrow at a negative real interest rate.
That's right. So the U.S. government sells, among other things, bonds that are protected against inflation. So the value won't be eroded by inflation. And the interest rate on 10-year inflation-protected bonds is minus 0.8% right now. So people are willing to pay the U.S. government to take their money.
So once you recognize that, and you recognize that we have these high-return investments in technology, infrastructure, anybody look at the infrastructure in New York, you have the feeling that we're a third world country, except it's an insult to some third world countries. You realize, investments in technology that would really provide the basis. We began by talking about how we got out of the Great Depression. Those kinds of investments would be a complement to the private sector and create jobs now and promote growth in the future and improve our fiscal position, because you have these positive real returns and the negative real cost of funds. Anybody looking at the balance sheet say you're crazy not to do it.
Well, my pet thing, of course, is that the greatest city and the greatest nation in the world is linked to all points west by a single rail tunnel completed in the year 1910. And the project, the long-standing project to add which runs at 100% of capacity during rush hour, and the long-standing project to add a second tunnel has been canceled at a time when when the federal government can borrow at negative real interest rates. Incredible.
And all of these idle resources do not pay taxes.
Right. No,
and people are worried about the debt over
it. Larry Summers and Brad DeLong, now that he's a free man, Larry is sounding a lot more like Joe and me, actually, but They had a paper making a very strong persuasive case that even in purely fiscal terms, spending more money now is a positive. That what it will do to the long-term budget, long-term U.S. economic growth will more than pay for itself in future tax revenue. That's because the borrowing costs are so low and because the long-term shadow of mass unemployment on the economy is quite large. So, yeah, and conversely, cutting back at times like this is self-defeating. It actually worsens the fiscal situation. And, of course, then what happens is people say, well, got to inflict more pain because the fiscal situation, it really is like medieval doctors who thought that you treated illness by bleeding people, yeah. And then they got sicker, so you bled them some more. And that's our economic policy these days.
Well, I'm getting depressed listening to you two guys, so I have to turn to the audience now.
Yeah.
Do people have questions? There are, I believe, microphones at a couple of places.
And, seems to be either.
Please come up. We've got some time for some questions. Yes, sir.
If I can make an observation before I pose my question. I appreciate the opportunity of hearing three brilliant people like yourselves discuss the issues. I suspect that if we had three equally distinguished economists with a different political persuasion, we'd have different answers and different observations. So let me get to my questions, okay? Number one, do you think the problems of the 99% are the result of what the 1% is doing to them? I don't want to monopolize the mic. I just want to ask you three questions and I'll disappear. So first question, is the problems of the 99% the result of what the 1% has done to them? Secondly, what do you think the appropriate maximum tax rate should be on the highest incomes in society? And three, how would you narrow the income differential between the factory floor worker and the CEO? 30 years ago, that differential was about 30 times. I think today it's about 500 times. Okay, and I wonder, how would you go about narrowing the differential? I assume the differential has occurred to some degree because China has brought down the wages of American factory workers. Now, why CEOs make what they make, I think, is an issue of governance. I totally agree with the observations you've made. But those three questions, if you could shed some light on your opinions.
Okay. Do the 1% cause the 99% problem?
Well, what I tried to explain before is that the difficulties of the 99% of the middle, are a result of a whole host of different things that we've talked about.
Yeah.
Right now the major problem is unemployment, but education, a whole host of financial sector deregulation, allowing predatory lending and abusive credit card practices and things like that. Now, you can say a lot of these are a result of the way our political process has passed rules and regulations and supported education or non-supported education. And that is affected, not even say by the 1%, but by the way money, the influence that money has had in our political process. So, yes, a lot of their plight is as a result of that. I don't even say all of it is. On the issue of the CEO pay relative to ordinary shareholder, ordinary workers, a lot of that has to do with corporate governance. If we had stronger laws about say and pay, I think that would be curbed, at least to some extent.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
It's a different ratio here than in other countries.
Well, Australia, yeah. For instance, has a strong say and pay law, and a very different ratio. And their companies are, just as efficient as our companies.
Yeah, also a stronger labor movement. We've had a very heavy tilt of policy against labor organizing, and that's an important restraining factor.
And
about the middle question, the answer is 73%.
73%.
No, that's Peter Diamond, who's a former colleague of mine and Nobel laureate and deemed unqualified to be on the Federal Reserve Board, but anyway, by Republicans in Congress. You don't have to take that exact number, but although he did actually put in that's not a plucked out of a hat. That's done with a lot of careful estimation. But there's a very strong economic argument that says that basically we should be taxing very high incomes at rates that yield revenue.
And there's one more factor.
Well, it doesn't quite. That we don't know. I mean, it's, I think it above my pay grade, but
after this book sells, you might be able
right.
To
right. But there's a clear case. The notion that you need to keep tax rates at the top low because of these wonderful spillovers, it's just not right. It's not borne out by theory or evidence, and much higher rates than we currently have at the very high end would actually be perfectly reasonable.
And remember, we were talking before about the period before 1980 and after 1980. Before 1980, with a period where we were growing the fastest, top tax rates were 70%.
That's right, with 70%.
Now, there's one more thing that I would add, which is you ought to think a little bit about the sources of income at the top. And if you identify a lot of the sources of income are monopoly power, all kinds of rent seeking, if you can target taxes on that kind of rent seeking, you'll actually generate income and improve economic efficiency. So most economists would say, to the extent that you could actually target those kinds of rents, you ought to tax that as close to 100% as you can.
I sense that if you had a higher marginal tax rate at the top, you would discourage the pursuit of rent-seeking.
Bit of evidence, actually, Kenny Sias, but anyway, that one of the reasons why we've had this explosion of corporate pay, of executive pay, is that the kind of brutal gaming of the system that CEOs now do in order to get these very high paychecks wasn't worth doing when the tax rates were much higher.
So the causality goes both ways, that when you have more economic inequality, the political process leads to less progressive taxation and more distorted tax system. But it's also when you have less progressive taxation and this kind of distortions, you wind up with an economic system with more inequality because people find it worthwhile to try to game the system.
Yeah. Okay. Over to the left here.
Hello?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
So there's been some criticism of the notion that economists as a group tend to look at the world as if the only thing that matters is efficiency and seeking the so-called rational solutions to problems of inefficiency. And I'm getting the strong sense that the two of you are not exactly in that camp, and that there's some sort of moral code that is at least in part underpinning your work and your views. And I wonder if you could articulate what that moral code is, a code for economists to live by.
Wow. I mean, I don't think the moral code for a person is any different if you're an economist than anything else. You try and do. But, and no, I think maybe let me answer a slightly different question, which I think is related, which is what is your social vision? What is it you want to see? And I don't know if Joe would subscribe to this, but I think I am more or less a Rawlsian without being too. The Rawls's notion was that you should think about society as if you were devising a society without knowing who you were going to be within it. That you should think of the hypothetical, the veil of ignorance. Say, if I didn't know whether I was going to be born the son of a corporate executive or the son of a migrant worker, what kind of society would I look for, given that it's really uncertain? So that it's a little bit like a golden rule sort of thing. That just consider the possibility of what would you want if you were going to be someone else. And that's don't have to be super formal about it. But I think that's the way. There was a great line saying that one of our two presidential candidates, instead of the veil of ignorance, starts from a social philosophy that starts from the veil of arrogance, which I thought was kind of nice. But anyway.
Yeah, let me just add one other thing, that some of the arguments we've been talking about this evening say that no matter what your view about your moral philosophy is, that the level of inequality that we've achieved in the United States is bad for almost all of us.
Yeah.
That we've actually got pushed the boundary beyond the point of where all of us in a way will suffer. So if we thought about this in terms of our enlightened self-interest, the 1% thought about it in terms of their enlightened self-interest, they would realize that it's not probably in their interest.
So there's one long-term study on education and socioeconomic status that I always think of in this context. It turns out that in America right now, they looked at students by test score and by socioeconomic background and then tracked them for a number of years later. And it turns out that in America right now, basically a A dumb rich kid is more likely to graduate college than a poor smart kid. That is telling you that there's an enormous waste of human potential, that there are millions, probably tens of millions of young Americans who could be doing great things for themselves and for the rest of us, who, because we have such an unequal society, are being denied that chance. Yeah. So that's
and it's
the
not
point
only equality, it's equality of opportunity, where, again, we are performing the worst of any of the advanced countries.
And the notion that you can divorce equality of results from equality of opportunity has turned out to be false. When the results are so unequal, it turns into an equality of opportunity as well.
I'll make a little plug. INET's doing a joint venture with the Union Theological Seminary. Joe Stiglitz kicked off the first in discussing his book about a month ago, and we'll be continuing that and filming that for our website at ineteconomics.org. And the gentleman who asked the question, I'll have to meet with you afterwards and get you an invitation to the next session, which is George Akerlof talking about the formation of identity on November 28th. Let's see, question on the
Thank
side.
Thank you. When I look at the last decade, I see a $5 trillion in debt run up under the Bush administration, a roughly comparable amount under the Obama administration. This $10 trillion seems to me to be a legacy of an extraordinary amount of pump priming, fiscal pump priming, and yet we have a legacy of economic problems. And now our sovereign debt is roughly around GDP, and this is the point at which, at least in Europe, investors have begun to question the capacity of the country to repay its debt. So I'm curious in what way future pump priming would be posed as a solution to problems that the past pump priming was not, and how can it be financed given our current balance sheet?
Look, we had a stimulus bill, which was about $800 billion. That's a very small part of this debt we have. And none of the rest was the result of deliberate efforts at economic stimulus. So where is this coming from? I mean, the rest of it is we have a large amount of debt that was we ran deficits even during good years, which even people like myself don't think is a good idea. Why? Because George Bush wanted to give tax cuts to high-income individuals, and he wanted to have a couple of unfunded wars. That has nothing to do with pump priming. And then we had a collapse of revenue that took place after 2007, which is the result of a severe downturn and financial crisis, which reflects at least in part, financial deregulation, a failure to understand that you need to actually have some oversight on the financial system and all of that. So the notion, this is that people talk as if we got our current level of debt through Keynesian policies. We didn't. It had very little to do with it. We got into our current level of debt through a combination of a more or less deliberate policy of starving the beast when the economy didn't need a budget deficit, coupled with mishandling of financial policy that helped create this economic crisis. All of that said, the notion that that bad things happen, that there's some red line on debt that we're somewhere close to, is just not borne out by the evidence.
Yeah.
It's a really poor piece of that. Look at who is in trouble right now in terms of debt, and it turns out to be only countries that are no longer have their own currencies and are in a special problem. I mean, the advanced countries that still have their own currencies, that have monetary independence, have repeatedly, both in current events and historically, been able to handle debt levels like we have right now without any
this
trouble.
This is a fallacy that's been partly propagated by a well-known book, Rogoff and Reinhardt.
It's not in your book. That's a very important. Reinhardt and Rogoff, Carmen Reinhardt and Kim Rogoff have a wonderful book about history of crises, although there's some mistakes. But then after the book, they threw out this very casual paper, which was just some raw correlations, saying that basically countries with high debt seem to have low growth. And if you start to look at it, it looks like it's actually the other way around. Countries that have low growth end up with high debt. It's really not up to the standard of their other world.
The United States had a debt to GDP ratio at the end of World War II of about 130%, and it was followed by the highest period of economic growth that we had, and we brought the debt down relatively quickly. So this notion that there is any magic number at which there's a problem is just false. The counterfactual, the way you should have asked the question, could have asked the question, is what would have happened?
Teacher.
Yes. And if this goes on for any length of time, one of us is going to say, that's a really good question. Right?
What would have happened if we hadn't allowed the deficit to increase. If we had tried to do the Herbert Hoover kind of policy of slash and cut back expenditures as the tax revenue went down, we did that experiment. And IMF has forced that experiment on a number of other countries. And the ECB and Europe have been forcing that on Greece. And we've found two things about that. One, the countries go into depression. And the other one is the deficit and doesn't get down as much as anybody hopes. They keep saying, oh, we're surprised. I'm surprised that they're surprised. Because it was perfectly anticipated that they would fail.
Hello, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity of for asking this question. So my question is slightly on a different topic, but it relates to the kinds of economic ideas that some U.S. groups have been promoting abroad. I'm an international student from Georgia, and this summer I went back and I went to an economics camp, which surprisingly was funded by a Tea Party organization, and they were promoting libertarianism among Georgian students. And there has been an emergence of orthodox economists back home, which has led to deregulation, less taxes, but also an increase of inequality. So my question is, how do you discuss alternatives to market fundamentalism in post-Soviet countries, which are so sensitive to this, to their historical experiences?
I missed what the country was.
Georgia.
Georgia. Okay.
I couldn't hear.
Well,
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible. Where we go from there is a choice I leave to you.
And now for something completely different.